had some tasty bread. I had
tasty bread.
Macaroni and cheese.
No, I think it was macaroni with like butter on top, maybe.
Okay.
A bit of
garlic
spices.
Macaroni.
Garlic
cheese.
Macaroni and cheese.
And there wasn't any cheese on the macaroni. So.
And
and squash.
Squash.
Bread. Lemon water. Good.
Bread with garlic bread. That's why they had spoken that it was good bread.
Now, was there a meal here last night as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been for 4 days in a row.
Okay. And who's doing the feeding?
They call him the bitch. His name is Sean, though, but he prefers to be called that. Kind of vulgar, but it's understandable.
Any hassles with the police or the hosts downtown around us?
I've been none. No trouble.
Any comments for Free Radio Santa Cruz from this trio on the bench here?
Comments?
You don't have to say anything. How should you? All right, thank you very much. A man who is beginning a new show at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Will you sign in, please?
This is the Audio Cranium.
You are the Audio Cranium.
Audio Cranium. Audio Cranium.
And when is your show, AC?
We're going to have it on 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Wednesdays.
8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Are you going to have a 14-hour show?
Oh, I wish I could have it on 14 hours, but it's going to be on 2 hours. And we're going to concentrate on...
You mean the evenings or the mornings?
Mornings, a.m.
I got you.
On your way
to 10 on Wednesdays.
On your way to back from work if you work grave shift.
And your three subjects of concentration will be?
Nursing homes. Nursing homes, child protection services, and homelessness and the mall issues.
Excellent.
Especially the host situation. We've got to get rid of these hosts and make this mall what it should be. The natural growth of what it's supposed to be. Artists, wherever have you. We're not the Capitola Mall here. We've got all sorts of natural things happening here, and we don't want to be sterilized like some high school. I've been to high school. I had my hall pass. I had my hall monitor, and I don't want to see it when I go shopping, for Christ's sake.
Okay. Are you going to have a moniker on this show? What are you calling yourself for this show?
Well, I'll be Audio.
You are Audio.
I am Audio.
So I am talking to Audio, and I hope you will be listening to Audio Wednesday 8 to 10 on Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's 96.3 FM, of course.
That's right. We'll see if we can get some special guests up that early in the morning and make it a strange show. A good show with all sorts of good music.
Cool. Thank you, Audio.
Thank you, Ron. There was dogs fighting and everything. It was really neat.
So, Audio, I'm asking about another subject here. You just brought it up. You said you noticed a change in the mood and the tolerance level, perhaps, for many vehicles on Tampa Beach.
Yeah, it was a couple of weeks ago. I'd gone over to Greyhound Rock, and last night I went over to Greyhound Rock, and there was nobody there. I also noticed that the trash was strewn all over the place by the laboratory there, and it was really depressing because who would do such a thing? I mean, it's a hard thing to do that. It's bad publicity. But I decided I might stay there alone, and I said, well, I've heard about people getting their vehicles ripped off there alone at night, so I decided to go on down to Panther Beach, and there was people all over the place. There was vehicles and dogs scuffling and people cooking hot dogs. And all sorts of wonderful things. Sure enough, it was quiet. No one bothered me. No one bothered me at all. And I had a nice night's sleep knowing that the ocean air and the Brussels sprout farts were laminating the seaside there next to me.
A poet as well as an audio man, eh?
Oh, we're going to have Kerouac and Keezy. We're going to have all sorts of, get some Lawrence and Getty and Gore Corso. All those old-time beats, and probably get some new poets, too. People who know what the streets are like today, you know, because the poets will never die. It was the job of a tyrant, the first job a tyrant would have, is to get rid of the poets, because those are the ones that can't be bought off, paid off, scared off, or lopped off. Well put, well put.
Well, again, thank you, Audio, on the report on Panther Beach, for those positive reports coming in. I'm I'm kind of pleased to see down here on the mall, there's not a lot of trash left from the, what do we call it, Sean Nut Bombs or Food Nut Bombs. Feed the people, I guess.
Feed the people.
Feed the ditch.
The ditch there.
Yes.
Hey, also, I want to make Mr. Morris that there is a free concert on Columbus Day going on in Golden Gate Park. And the number to contact is 1-800-259-0695. And that will be a number that you call for free, of course, and find out what's going to happen on Sunday night. It'll start at a full moon in front of Ben and Jerry's on Haight. There'll be a drum circle going on. Probably close off the whole street
next Sunday.
Sunday after this coming up.
Right.
Week from Sunday.
A week from this Sunday
night. And then on Columbus Day, there'll be a big concert, and you can call that number and find out who's going to be there. Okay. They also want you to call
that number again.
Let's see. 1-800-259-0695.
Thank you, Audio.
No problem.
It's September 26th. I'm on the corner with a longtime peace and homeless activist, Brian.
Robert, this involves charges. They charged her with assault.
So Gina, what do we call her? Gem Eyes Gina, whoever. She was the woman with the marathon, Mark Webster, who helped to actually establish the tent rules back this spring for the open-air shelter, the only legal place for people to sleep outside in Santa Cruz. And Brian, you say that she's been asked to leave the open-air shelter?
She got in a fight last night, and the police were ready to arrest her. She's been given a ticket for assault on one of the employees.
Name the employee?
I don't know.
We actually had a show on Monday on FLSC.
Police almost took her away last night, basically, after she had an altercation in the parking lot, and then they kicked her out of the campground and the day center.
Do you feel that she's a danger to people at the campground or the day center?
Well, I've spoken with both sides, and one side thinks that she broke two ribs on this guy, or cracked two of his ribs, and Gina basically feels that she's been assaulted, even though she was charged with assault.
Any other witnesses to this whole incident that you spoke to?
Well, the problem is that the problem is finding a friendly witness, because a lot of people don't like Gina because of incidents with her dog. And she went through all these incidences with her dog, and so there's like this whole group of people who doesn't like her. So it's hard to find a friendly witness, somebody, you know, who's impartial to either side.
Are you a witness yourself, or did you come on the scene?
No, by the time I got into the parking lot, the two police were having her sit in a chair.
Sit in a chair. Now, you're on the Open Air Shelter Subcommittee that is investigating. And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. These are taped interviews of the last week around Santa Cruz, down in the mall, down at Food Not Bombs, and Feed the People Meals. I'm your host, Bathrobe Spear, Robert Norse, and this is Bathrobe Spear's Broadsides. Hopefully, a show that will roll on until 1 o'clock. We do it twice a week, Monday and Fridays, starting at 10 in the morning. We have a call-in number, 427-3772. We do invite you to call in. And we have some upcoming guests, so we're expecting to call or to call in, including Calamity Jane Immler, long-lost mother of us all, homeless activist, calling long distance to give us an update on, of all things, the plan to close the open-air shelter this winter and leave it closed and put in its place Community House, Citizens Committee for the Homeless low rent project that will serve 50 people while the campground currently serves 200. You can tell by the tone of my voice what I think of this. I've discussed it in other shows. I'm going to be talking about it more on this show. Other guests that will be coming in soon, hopefully, we're going to contact Paul Merceau, who is head of the open air shelter and is also on the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which runs the open-air shelter and had its executive directors, board of directors meeting last night, where I spoke briefly, and he's going to tell us what their decision was around this issue. We're going to be talking about that more, and who knows. Kate Wells is also due to come wandering in, if she remembers. Kate, or Catnip Kate, as I call you, don't forget us. Come on down. You're listening again to Free Radio, and I'm afraid I may be gone on Monday, next Monday, and what we'll be doing instead is playing taped interviews of the kind you've just been listening to. In a way, that's much better because frequently you can learn a lot more by listening to the people who actually experience injustice, abuse, problems, and who actually are helping to resolve those problems, like the people who are feeding people on the streets, the people who are monitoring police and host misconduct. And you can perhaps learn how you can get involved, and how you can get involved directly is to give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. HUFF stands for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and there's a recorded message on that line. It's me, actually. It's my home phone. You give a call, I'll get back to you, and I'll hook you up with the people who are doing these various projects. Another group you can call is Food Not Bombs, 425-3345. They've been serving people here for over 2 years. Actually, it's almost 3 years now, I think. They serve Wednesday afternoon on the mall. They serve at 4 o'clock. They serve Saturdays and Sundays at River and Josephine at 1 o'clock. They serve Tuesday mornings at 11 o'clock at Loudon Nelson Park. All these times they need people to cut vegetables, serve food, pick up food from different donors, make phone calls, help with rummage sales and other things. This isn't just your ordinary charity gang. These are people who are feeding people directly without any government assistance, with the active opposition from the merchant community in many cases. I spoke to Lori Hennings of the Farmers Market on Wednesday, and there was a controversy involving Food Not Bombs at the Farmers Market about a year ago, when apparently Hennings had instructed the Farmers Market merchants, grocery merchants, not to give food to Food Not Bombs. And we interviewed her, and she later denied this, but it was my impression that that was in fact what she had told people. And she reiterated again on Wednesday that Food Not Bombs hadn't showed up much at the Farmers Market, but the Farmers Market merchants were being encouraged to give to a church donor. And she wasn't sure what church that was, but apparently the practice may well still be the same. So I encourage you to call Food Not Bombs at 425-3345 if you want to donate any of your time, services, a vehicle, expertise in fixing a vehicle, money. They can always use money, and believe me, that's one of the best groups to donate to. If you want to see your money in the hands of honest people who try to strain every penny out of that dollar and make sure it gets into food for people, they don't take salaries. They just pay for gas. And they pay for the condiments. They don't even pay for the food. They get the food donated. So, Food Not Bombs, 425-3345. We're going to have a report, by the way, from Keith McHenry, who is a Food Not Bombs San Francisco chapter worker, who has taken a Food Not Bombs tour on the road, his second such national tour, and is now on the East Coast rambling up and down in his vehicle with his dog, Pluto, who was wounded in combat, or perhaps not in combat, an innocent dog, somewhere in mid-Canada, but now is recovering, we're all glad to hear. And I haven't got a voice interview as I did last week from him, but I do have a kind of a report, and I'll be giving you that update later in the show. So, this leaves me a little dangling here. I often lose my thread here. I think I need a monitor to put me back on track. In any case, I was going to say that next Monday we're probably going to have tapes, and that's, as I said, a good thing. You certainly can call in if anything on the air you have disagreed with or want to add to or respond to. The interview by Brian Koepke, Bubba Brian as I call him, a longtime homeless activist who also works for the Day Resource Center, and Karen Gillette, we're going to have Gina, who is the woman he's talking about, who has been expelled from the open-air shelter, allegedly for violence. We'll hopefully have her on the show. We've done several interviews with her, but we want to have her on the show as well. We're also trying to, I and Candlelight Kim Argula and other activists are trying to get her together with Karen Gillette and Paul Marceau, the expelling parties. I guess Karen, I'm not sure who exactly expelled her, but I guess certainly had to go by both of those people. I think Karen gathered the information and Paul probably did the expelling. so that there can be some kind of a mediation process, and she can again have access to the field if she's in fact, as I believe her to be, a passionate but generally not dangerous person. Dangerous if you assault her, but only if you are in fact doing that. That is her claim. So I have a couple things I'm going to read to you that are really updates on what's been happening. And I'm going to ask the new member of the studio, who I will not introduce, to keep an eye on the telephone. So if the telephone flashes, I don't ignore you. Thought I'd mention that again on the air. Here's a story that might interest some of our listeners. It's you may have noticed it in today's Chronicle. Judge continues ban on redwood logging. That's in today's San Francisco Chronicle, September 29th, Friday. A federal judge agreed yesterday to continue to block logging in Humboldt County's Headwater Forest, ruling that serious questions remain about the effects of timber cutting on the forest's endangered or threatened species. The preliminary injunction issued by U.S. District Judge Maxine Chesney in San Francisco effectively extends her temporary order of 2 weeks ago. Unlike that order, however, Pacific Lumber Company can appeal yesterday's ruling, a step that the company is still considering. I do find that because there are serious questions that merit further litigation, a preliminary injunction is warranted, Chesney said to a crowded courtroom that immediately erupted in applause and cheering. Chesney's order bars Pacific Lumber from logging until a trial on the need for further environmental studies. The main issue is whether U.S. Food and Wildlife Service must conduct a biological assessment of the effects of timber harvesting on the northern spotted owl, the marbled murrelet, and other protected species. The judge found yesterday that if logging were to start now, there would be a reasonable certainty of imminent harm to wildlife living in the forest stands of redwoods and Douglas firs. The grant of the injunction marks the latest development in a 10-year struggle over the fate of about 5,500 acres of forest that includes the Headwaters Forest, which contains the world's last unprotected groves of ancient redwoods. Lawsuits have blocked logging on the land since 1985, when a Houston-based company, Maxim Incorporated, acquired Pacific Lumber in a hostile takeover. Pacific Lumber at first agreed to a moratorium on timber cutting while state and federal officials tried to buy Headwaters. These efforts failed, however, and in March, the state granted the company a legal exemption that allowed it to cut up to 10% of dead, dying, or diseased trees without undergoing the usual environmental reviews. But the exemption resulted in further protests and lawsuits. On September 15th, the first day that logging would be permitted, about 2,000 environmentalists demonstrated outside a Pacific Lumber sawmill, while lawyers for the Environmental Protection Information Center obtained a temporary restraining order from Judge Chesney. Attorneys for the government and the lumber company argued yesterday that all legal procedures have been met and that no further permission was needed for the company to remove fallen trees. But Chesney said there was a serious question of whether the federal government's advice to Pacific Lumber on how to protect endangered habitats constituted government action, thereby triggering legal requirements for further study. An attorney for the company said he did not know whether it would appeal. Although Pacific Lumber wants to remove dead or dying trees for safety reasons, the order, quote, does not put Pacific Lumber Company in a position where it doesn't have logs to run its mills, he said. This is from the Chronicle legal affairs writer Reynolds Holding in the Today's San Francisco Chronicle, page A26, for those of you who are interested in the Headwaters situation, and I know many of you are. This is not a local civil liberties issue, so I'm making a rare exception to talk about this issue on the show. I think it's an important issue to many of our listeners, so I am bringing it up. But let me remind you, you are listening, indeed, to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert. I have a studio full of ornery activists, some of whom I will name, some of whom I won't. In fact, entering the inner sanctum of the studio, we have the notorious local attorney, Ed Fry.
Notorious.
Ed, sign in.
Yes, that's I. Thank you. Hello.
Yeah, that's Ed Fry. He has a clipping in his hand. What exactly is this clipping, Ed, before we attempt to pressure you to help Robert Flory?
Yes, this is a clipping about the hearing that we had in the Art Danner matter earlier this week. We're suing Art Danner as taxpayers to get the money back that he spent.
Art Danner is our district attorney here.
Yes, the very one, our district attorney. He spent a lot of money for Catherine Gardner, giving her free salary and benefits for 4 months.
And who is Catherine Gardner?
Catherine Gardner is the assistant district attorney who was very unfairly fired by Art Danner when she went to him. to tell her, him about her problems that she was having with an ex-boyfriend who was very abusive and had forced her to take cocaine on one occasion and had taken his marijuana plant and placed it on her deck and took a picture of it and was trying to extort money from her after the relationship had broken up. She went to him because the guy was a very abusive person. Even after the relationship was broken up, he was trying to get $7,000 out of her. So he turned it on her, and he said, "Oh well, we can't have a district attorney who's
eating our dinner.
Yeah, we can't have a district attorney who's using drugs, and I'm going to fire you."
And this was the beginning of this year, or
This was in 1994, March of 94, just after the election campaign was started. I was running against him for DA.
So there was an election campaign for district attorney in the course of which this potential scandal emerged.
Right, and Art Danner was very sensitive to the charge of a district attorney using mind-altering substances, because I had charged him 4 years earlier when I ran against him in 1990 for his drunk driving, where he actually injured a woman very seriously by plowing head-on into her after he had been drinking multiple gins and tonics at the Holiday Inn.
But didn't get a blood test, I understand.
No, he didn't get a blood test, but she did. Even though she was on the gurney waiting to be x-rayed at the hospital, the police insisted on taking her blood.
Well, we know Art is drunk on success, but certainly not drunk on alcohol.
Anyway, he was very sensitive to the criticism of a district attorney using anything that would alter the mind. So he didn't want this to come out during the election, so he told her, he said, "Catherine, go home and pretend you're sick. If anybody asks, you're sick. You understand? I'll pay you your salary for a while."
Now, how do we know he told her that?
Because she told me he told her that.
Uh-huh. You actually spoke to Catherine Gardner.
On many occasions, yes. Mm-hmm. And so what he did was he paid her for 4.5 months of full salary and benefits in exchange for no work. She just sat at home. And then he fired her. So
sort of that broke the deal that he had with her? Or?
Well, no, he didn't make any deal with her. He just said, "Go home and be quiet." That's all he said. And meanwhile, he didn't tell anybody. See, he was only entitled to pay her for 5 days. That's what the county regulations very clearly limit him to, 5 days of leave with pay. He gave her 4.5 months of leave with pay. And it was merely, what it amounted to was a $40,000 campaign contribution, which he appropriated from county funds in order to keep this whole thing quiet during the election. Then after the election in July, he fired her.
And she had done nothing during that time. On what basis did he fire her?
On the basis that she was using drugs.
On the basis that she had used drugs in January or February, or?
On the basis that she had used drugs the previous year, and that this was the basis for the extortion claim by her former boyfriend.
And yet we know that he knew about this claim early in the year, 4 months previous to firing her.
Right. He found out on March the 18th, 1994, and continued to pay her for 4 more months. Now, she shouldn't have been fired in the first place. It was wrongful termination, and that's why one of the things he was worried about, that she was going to sue the county. But he didn't, in exchange for giving her all this money, he didn't get any release of liability from her. She didn't sign anything. And in fact, after the whole thing was over, she sued the county.
And what was the result of that lawsuit?
Her lawsuit against the county was dismissed because she found another job and didn't want to pursue it. But I'm suing him to get him, not her, but him, to pay the money back, because it was actually for his benefit.
Before we get into your lawsuit, a little bit more about her lawsuit. Do you know from her that is why she is not pursuing the lawsuit? Have you had conversations with her?
No, I have not talked with her since she dismissed her lawsuit. She has moved away. She's in Southern California as a prosecutor. She found another job. This is a woman who was a prosecutor all of her professional life. She was with the DA here for 9 years. That's all she wants to do with her life, is be a prosecutor. And she finally found another job. The reason the whole thing came out was that she insisted upon her right to a public hearing before the Civil Service Commission. It could have been private, but she insisted that it be public. And in the course of this public hearing, it came out that Art Danner had been paying her for all this time in exchange for no work.
Now, is there any place that people can get copies of the transcript of this hearing, either from a public agency or possibly from some private group such as the Coalition to Recall Danner, I understand?
You can get a tape recording of it from the personnel department, but it costs $60 because it's 8 different tapes. I have a transcript of it, and I could, if people wanted to photocopy it, they could contact me. But in the course of that hearing, after it was over, the County Civil Service Commission made a special finding. It said that all that pay and benefits to Catherine Gardner was excessive, and that there was no reasonable explanation for the delay in firing her. She should have been, if you're going to fire her, then fire her. Don't drag it out for 4.5 months and pay her in the meantime. You know, there's just no justification for that.
Now, if people want to contact you for more documentation or information, how should they go about that? And we're not concluded with this interview by any means, but I'm going to throw this in right here.
They could call me, 457-1545.
457-1545 if you want to contact Attorney Ed Fry. He is discussing the case of Art Danner, who he is currently suing in court for misappropriation of funds. Is that appropriately put?
Absolutely, yeah. We sued him in March of this year to require him to repay the money, and then the county council, less than a month after we sued him, the Board of Supervisors formally approved and ratified what he had done. They came down with a formal resolution, I think at the urging of Art Danner and County Council, Dwight Herr. And the Board of Supervisors formally approved it in a resolution. So when I filed, in response to my suit, the County Council made a motion for summary judgment. And we have a call now, so let's stop there and let's take that.
You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz with Ed Fry and Bathrobes Pierre Robert.
Good morning, Santa Cruz from DeSoto, Missouri.
Ooh, it sounds like Calamity Jane Emler on the phone.
I think it is, yes, right.
We have dueling guests here. We have Ed Fry and we have you. Say hello to Calamity Jane, Ed.
Hi, Jane.
Good morning, Ed. How are you?
Good to talk to you.
Oh, it's good to talk to you, too.
Scott's in Sacramento, by the way.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Well, I never know where he is.
That silly jet setter. He's all over the place.
Right.
So Scott is your son who's also heading up the medical marijuana activities around here in Santa Cruz.
Right, exactly.
And I was kind of introducing you earlier in the program, and you have come in the middle of Ed Fry's a peroration, a very appropriate speech on and discussion of the issue of Art Danner and the misappropriation of funds in the Catherine Gardner case.
Would you want to call me back?
I can try and call. Well, this is the studio radio. I'm calling long distance. I will probably be beat about the head and shoulders.
That's okay. You could use a good beating.
You think I could, huh?
I think so.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. Ed, can you hang on for a few minutes, or who can hang on longest is the question.
Well, I'm calling long distance, so obviously he can.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll hang on.
All right. Well, I want you, Ed, to hang on, and our listeners, perhaps you can also hang on, because those of you who have been listening to Ed's discussion of Catherine Gardner, I know you want to hear what the latest upshot was. There was a trial or a hearing on last Friday, and Ed's going to tell us the results of that hearing and what's going to happen with Art Danner, our erstwhile district attorney. Maybe before you talk about the subject that I was going to suggest you call in on, Jane, namely the open-air shelter, you might want to give us your sense of Art Danner and the kind of DA he's been with respect to the homeless and the poor.
Oh, well, you know, Art originally, I think Supervisor Gary Patton put Art Danner on the first homeless, what we called it, hopeless task force, to educate him about the homeless. Now, since I've been gone for a while, I don't know how well educated he's become, but, you know, that's a little bit of history for you.
That was back in the mid-80s, I believe?
I think it was 85, right, 1985.
Okay, and so, weren't you prosecuted by Art Danner for feeding poor people around 1989 or so?
Oh, I think we were, 88, 89, yes, we were prosecuted by Art Danner. But Art Danner, that was before they had all that you couldn't get into his office thing that they've set up now. So, you know, he was always pretty amenable. I mean, we could always go in there. I think you were with us a few times when we burst into his office and sat down and did a few sit-ins in his office. And, you know, he was always...
I remember those, yeah.
Right.
The good old days. Yes. Well, So you have no particular comments on Art Danner that come to mind at this moment?
Well, now you know. I mean, I love everybody, Robert. I mean, you know.
Can't get an endorsement to recall Art Danner from you, huh?
Well, now, if that meant they were going to put Ed in, well, of course, I'd go for that.
Yeah, for
but, you know, there's the whole issue of my dear long-gone friend now, Linda Edwards, whatever happened to her, the case that they were going to supposedly prosecute man who abused her.
Oh, yeah, Linda Edwards and the Brian Flanagan Staley case. That Linda died, our listeners may be aware, in last June of liver cancer, and as I've discussed on this program several times, in the 24 hours before she died, she was victimized and assaulted and battered by, at least that was the recommendation of the Detective Wilson who investigated the case, that charge be filed against Brian Flanagan Staley, a homeless activist with an otherwise commendable record for work back in the late 80s with us. You may remember Brian. Mm-hmm. But of course, this action is,
I think that the Danner's office has a long history of really not looking for people that may have abused or murdered homeless people. There's, you know, everybody seems to drown, gets drunk and drowns. I mean, that turns up suddenly dead. So, I mean, I have a lot of concerns about that. But.
Troll busting, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Well, actually, the reason I asked you to call, and probably the case I should get to, although we haven't yet really gone into it in any detail on the air, is the situation of the Open Air Shelter, which is a program that's been running for 2 years, essentially a homeless campground that's free to people at Highway 1 and Highway 9, run by the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which is a sort of a group that usually puts people in churches and transports them to the Armory in the winter. But this was a summer campground that was run on property purchased by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. I'll give you some more information on that purchase, which I found out since I last spoke to you, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
We actually intend to interview Paul Merceau, who's the head of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program and the director of the Open Air Shelter, later on the show afterwards. He unfortunately will not be able to hear you unless he's listening on the radio. If you are, Paul, please comment when you call in, and it's unfortunate you can't fly in for the show, Jane. You could be here at the board with me and Ed answering questions.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't been able to lure you back here to Santa Cruz yet. Anyway, the Open Air Shelter is really a continuation of a program that was started by desperate need and the initiative of activists back in 1988 who began sleeping on the property, which I'm going to ask you to give your understanding of the history of its purchase and the kind of funding that went into it, since, as I understand it, your hunger fasts of the mid-80s were responsible for the acquisition of that property in the first place. But the key issue that we're eventually going to come around to is, should this property, should the Citizens Committee for the Homeless be allowed to evict 150 to 200 campers and to set up what they call community house, essentially, I don't know, 8 or 10 modular housing trailers donated by Stanford University, where they're going to put in some low-income renters of 40 or 50 people. That's what they plan to do. I heard announced yesterday, both at the Open Air Shelter Subcommittee meeting and at their own Citizens Committee for the Homeless Board of Directors meeting. They intend to do this in mid-December, if not sooner. Then they're going to move the free meal indoors, and they're going to evict everybody from the site. They will go into winter shelter. Armory will take care of most of them, but some of them, of course, won't use the place during the winter when it's closed, quote-unquote, but people still use it. And then next spring, on April 1st, when the winter armory is closed, you will have everybody, and I mean everybody, vulnerable to the camping ban. That Santa Cruz City law that makes it illegal for people to sleep outside and gives them no legal place to sleep at all, even in their cars, even on private property with the permission of the owner, with the exception of the church parking lots, which are now an exception because of an amendment passed this summer by the city council. So let me begin by asking you to give a history of this, or if you want to comment on anything I said, you can, of course. But maybe, how did you get involved in Santa Cruz and in terms of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless and their acquisition, or the acquisition by the city of this property, since the city was the first owner of this property?
Well, I returned to Santa Cruz in 1985, in the winter of 85, to finish up my degree at UC. And while hiking through the woods one day up at UC, I came across a man and a woman and a small baby who were homeless and trying to keep warm around a campfire. It was a cold, rainy day. And I had been involved in the homeless movement in Los Angeles prior to that. So, I mean, I had some sense of it. And so at that point, I got involved with Peter Carota, who was trying to open a shelter at the, they were talking about developing a shelter in conjunction with their soup kitchen. After, 9, 10 months of meeting with officials and demonstrating and marching and meeting with officials.
This is 1984 or so.
1985. Mm-hmm. It became, and finally, then director Susan Mariello, who's now the CEO, but at that point was the head of Human Resource Agency, telling us that she was not going to recommend a shelter to the Board of Supervisors because the town wasn't ready for it. I decided, with the support of Shannon Casamo and Peter Carota, to do a hunger strike. That lasted 31 days, and out of that came the first ever temporary shelter.
Now, you did that hunger strike at the town clock, as I remember.
No, actually, I was living in Ben Lomond that time, and we most of that time was spent there. The second hunger strike, was done at the town clock. But anyway, so we got the Cedar Street shelter, and it was at that point, it was at the Cedar Street shelter, once that got opened up, which was in December.
Cedar Street is a building that it was then later used next to the Cumboy Jazz Center.
Right, uh-huh.
And it was a building essentially lent by Bob Lissner,
right,
or rented
exactly.
by Bob Lissner, whom I ran into, by the way, the other day.
Oh, really?
And he told me the chief people who objected to it were Gary Patton on the Board of Supervisors and everybody in the city council. Was there a lot of problem opening up that shelter?
Oh, there was. There was a great problem. I was fading fast, and I was hospitalized, and they originally wanted to open one up over there by the county health center, and there was a building they had over there, but the neighbors got together, and they stormed into the supervisors and said no, and then Lister came in with that building, but it was once we got that open that Paige Smith, who I understand just learned a little bit ago, has since passed on, has died, began to send out word, and we had the first ever Citizens Committee for the Homeless meeting at that Cedar Street shelter, and that's when it started. And the objective was to find a site for a permanent shelter. And from the first site they went after was Potrero Street. That was bought up out from under us by concerned neighbors in the area. And the next building was what is now the River Street Shelter and the subsequent campground. And that was owned by the university. It was being used as an extension for the university. And as that progressed, I mean, we were only in the Cedar Street Shelter till April. And then the people were back out on the street.
April of 1985, yes.
86.
86, sorry.
And then people were back out on the street. And, you know, in fact, when they left, the terribly sad part of that was when they left the Cedar Street shelter, they were under the impression they were going to Potrero Street. And I remember one homeless woman, Jeannie, who many in the town I'm sure know.
She's still around. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I haven't been there for a while.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, yesterday.
Right. But she actually went over and started sleeping under the tree at Potrero Street, thinking that was a shelter, and promptly got arrested for camping over there. So, anyway, so there was a great deal of disappointment. So the next site was the River Street shelter. Now, there was some of us, I mean, the River Street site, now some of us that really weren't sold on that, Linda LeMaster, Shannon Casamo, myself, because the site was too small. We thought that it wouldn't shelter very many people, but they said, oh, well, you know, we'll be able to build on and add on and make more beds and all that.
Let me come in on that for a minute, Jane.
Sure.
Actually, we had a meeting yesterday with the city council members, Catherine Byers, Celia Scott, including Sherry Connable, an activist who was involved around 1990 in the Coalition for a Safe Place to Sleep, which attempted to set up the
what is now the open air shelter under private aegis, and the city council turned her down. You may remember that.
Yes.
Their claim now is that the open air shelter has outgrown the site it's in. So I think you're talking about the River Street shelter
and the two beds,
but even the outdoor part of that property is now insufficient to house the people that are there.
I'm sure, and if the welfare cuts go through, it'll be even more insufficient. But,
sure.
And I don't know how many in the community know, but I was always opposed to opening that up as an open-air shelter behind the River Street shelter just because of the toxicity of the site, both the ground, there's a cement plant back there, the fumes, and homeless people don't tend to be the healthiest in the world.
This is a site next to the freeway as well, right?
Right, exactly. And it was actually Sherry Connable who put that whole motion into, started meeting with the homeless when I left town to come back here for my grandson's birth. But anyway, it's my understanding then we did the second hunger strike because the city had decided they would not buy the River Street shelter. The negotiations with the university broke down.
This was in 1986.
And about eight of us started another hunger strike. And we got, they started another temporary shelter under that hunger strike, which was over there down in the beach flats. I forget the name of it. But anyway, the negotiations opened back up with the university. Paige Smith actually went up to the chancellor and said, you know, you got all these people on a hunger strike down in Santa Cruz. If we don't get this going, you know, people are going to start dying. He said that they didn't really care. But anyway, the upshot was is they did buy the property. It was bought with community development block grant funding, I believe, most of it. And at some point...
This is property that includes both the current River Street shelter, which now houses 36,
right.
Has 36 beds, but then only had, 14 beds, and two of them were assigned to homeless people, right?
Exactly.
And it also houses the open-air shelter and the free meal, which is the subject of a discussion that I've been, you know, involved in a lot in the last few months.
Right. And that, you know, and that was all purchased with those fundings. At some point, the back section, which is the open-air shelter, was deeded over to the community because the city bought those funds. The deal was the city would operate the shelter with county funding. And I think it was either William James or for the first people that ran the shelter was actually the homeless community group. It was Fred Gray was the manager.
The Citizens Committee for the Homeless?
Right. They were actually the first operators of the shelter. At some point, the back site got turned over to the homeless community thing. What is it? I keep forgetting.
Citizens Committee for the Homeless.
I have a mental block about that.
Yeah.
And I think they got it for $1. And according to Fred Gray, who helped draw up the contract, it was supposed to return to the city if community house wasn't bought within a year or 2 years or whatever.
Let me interrupt for a minute here.
Yeah.
Community house is, again, a project which the Citizens Committee for the Homeless...
Don't turn it over.
I'm sorry. There's a local technical problem here. Which the Citizens Committee for the Homeless... had been planning to build for some time,
mm-hmm.
supposedly, but which some of us regard as a sort of a fund magnet, a sort of a raison d'etre for there being a fundraiser thing, which, you know, although it may well have been an ideal by Paige Smith, who really wanted such, and we all need transitional housing, the practical policies of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, at least for many of the years that it's been around, has been to harass and arrest those who want to make sure that property stays open as a campground. That happened to me in 1991. I was arrested on that property in October, along with two other people, and 27 people were driven off by police when we attempted to make sure, after trying petitioning and other means, that the Citizens Committee for the Homeless did not evict people from the property.
Yes, I think Scott Kennedy and I were there, along with Paul Frindell and others, watching you being taken off to jail.
Yes, indeed.
Exactly.
I should also say, however, that in conversations with Paul Merceau, the head of the open air shelter now, that his information was that the property was purchased for $350,000 by the Citizens Committee in 1991 from the city on the basis of large grant loans or some donations from two big churches, including
One large church and the Red Cross, so he has different information than you do about how much money they paid to the city to get the property and the conditions under which it was obtained.
Well, I think that, I mean, that may well be true, but I strongly doubt it, and I would suggest that anybody's really interested in it, they should find the documents, because it was supposed to revert to the city, and there's a lot of, you know, there was just like a paper transfer back then. And the bottom line of all this is...
Have you seen the documents yourself?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
No, but the bottom line is, I mean, I know Don Lane...
Don Lane, a former city council member,
right,
then mayor...
Had vouched for that at the time, mm-hmm. that it was supposed to revert to the city if the community house didn't build on it for a year or two. But all that aside, I mean... It was the general consensus back then. The reason the city even went for that parcel was because they wanted to control any kind of an attempt to make an eastern access to the university, and that would be where it would head up. And so there was always that sense that that was, you know, if they had an opportunity to buy it with federal funds, and then they could have some say about. What happened to that land.
So initially the property was purchased with the CDBG grant funds, which now I've been calling those homeless monies. Is that accurate?
Well, I was thinking that was CDCB, Community Development Block Grant Funds. Now, there was also the McKinney Funds. Now, I think that the McKinney Funds went to purchase that adjacent building, which was supposed to be the Homeless Health Center. Which, as you can remember, I don't know if things have changed, but you can never get them to disperse any help.
McKinney is the federal act which provides funding for homeless people, homeless services, acquisition of homeless
but
properties.
But I think that funding now has been gutted pretty much.
Right.
Mr. Snyder was really did a lot of work along with Leon Panetta in making that all happen.
Mr. Snyder, national homeless activist, Leon Panetta, now presidential assistant, then congressional representative from our district.
Yeah, that's what he was then. Yeah, now he's
So, well, what's your take on this right now? What I found is that at this meeting yesterday I had with the